Okay, thank you. Well, if we still have about half an hour, so I'm trying to stick to that. And I'm not going to talk all about the latest development which I've done, but instead I've decided to try to give kind of like an overview of the some of the basic concepts of the spin transfer torque from a theoretical point of view. And then if you would like to talk to me further, I'm going to be here until next week about more details. So this is kind of like a warm-up to the domain wall, current induced domain wall. So I'm going to talk about, first remind you about how we describe the dynamics of a single ferromagnet, and then how we can understand the spin transfer torque, which also leads to new interesting dynamics for this single ferromagnet. And then I'm going to tell you about another concept, which is also related to the spin transfer torque, which is spin pumping, which exists if this magnet actually starts to be excited, if it starts to precess. And then if I do have time, which I actually think I will not have time, but if I do have time, then I'll also talk about some noise properties of these systems, which are, again, are related to both the spin transfer torque and the spin pumping. And I'll give some conclusions. All right, so let's start with the simplest. And the simplest is that we have a single ferromagnet. And this is the single ferromagnet. And in order to make this even simpler, we can imagine that we excite it, and we excite it really by a rotation, not a precession. And rotation doesn't exist in nature, more or less, but let's just assume that it rotates for now. And then how do one describe the dynamics of this ferromagnet? That's done by the Landau-Lipschitz-Gilbert equation. So one has an effective magnetic field, which drives the precession. And then there is a damping constant, which describes the dissipation of energy out of the system to some other degrees of freedom. And finally, there are also some fluctuations, which make sure that this system will actually reach the lowest energy state. And the fluctuations and the Hilbert damping are related in the fluctuation dissipation theorem. And this description holds pretty well for most even small-scale ferromagnets, although the Gilbert damping is usually put in by hand by some phenomenological arguments. One can try to calculate it, but not all of those calculations are so precise. Now, what about the spin transfer torque? So that's something that exists out of equilibrium. So we know that if we have a ferromagnet, then we have different resistivities for spin up and spin down electrons on going through this ferromagnet. So we can think of this loosely as if there is some kind of spin-dependent force on the electrons coming from this magnet. And then we know that there is a Newton's third law, so since there is some force on these electrons from the magnet, then there should also be a force from these electrons onto the magnet itself. And this is what Luc Pecher first realized. He looked at the domain wall resistance, the resistance of domain walls, and he showed that if you pass a current through such a domain wall, you can actually move the domain wall because there is a force on the domain wall from this current, which is actually caused by this the fact that the electron would like to align its spin with the magnetization in this domain structure. Now, one does not need a continuous variation of the magnetization in order to have such a spin transfer effect. It's enough to have two discrete ferromagnetic elements, and this is what John Schmoszewski studied. So he studied a discrete system and initially a tunnel contact, but it doesn't really matter what kind of contact you have. The physics is similar. And then if you now pass a current from one to the other, you also pass a flux of spins, which then exerts a force onto the other ferromagnet. And although you might have heard all this before, I'm now going to describe how do we understand this spin transfer torque. Where does it come from? So let's consider that we have a normal metal in contact to a ferromagnet. And let's say that the magnetization of that ferromagnet comes out of the plane here, out of this blackboard. And let's study now what happens when I send one electron in from the normal metal onto this ferromagnet. then we know, of course, that this electron, this it can be reflected or it can be transmitted. But the electron also has a spin direction, and let's now assume that we consider the electrons that have a spin which is perpendicular to the magnetization in the ferromagnet, to be simple. So then nothing really happens in the norm metal if we now consider the limit that there is no spin flip going on in the norm metal. But in the ferromagnet, this spin will now experience this perpendicular magnetic field, and as a result of that, it will start to precess or rotate in this extreme case. That's if it goes into the ferromagnet, but the electron can also come back into norm metal, and typically it comes back into norm metal after spending a small amount of time within the ferromagnet. So that means that when it comes back, it can come back at a slightly different angle of its spin than it had initially. And how large difference there is between the spin it had when it entered the ferromagnet and the spin it has when it comes back depends on how much time it actually spent in the ferromagnet. So that's the reflected spin. Now this picture is for a single quantum state. So if you now consider what is the induced magnetization on the ferromagnetic side of the system, then one will see that the induced magnetization will oscillate because of this precession in the ferromagnet. Now in a metal, and especially for ordinary metals, which I'm mostly considering here, we have a huge macroscopic number of different quantum states. So it means that we will have superpositions of all these kinds of induced magnetizations in the ferromagnet. And that leads to a defacing of this induced magnetization. The magnetization or the spin accumulation that we initially sent in perpendicular to the magnetization. So after a very small length scale, whatever spin accumulation we send in which is perpendicular to magnetization will be lost. And this short length scale is typically of the order of Fermi wavelength because the exchange energy in ferromagnets is of the same order of magnitude as the Fermi energy. So that means that in a typical ferromagnet, this spin defacing length is... Yeah?
So you can see the direction also perpendicular with the plane?
Okay, so I am... Okay.
Z, yes?
Oh, sorry.
Okay,
sorry, so that's probably, yeah, so okay, so that's probably, let's go back.
Is this along the direction?
Let me see, this magnetization I'm plotting now, okay, so this set on the left there is actually incorrect. I think it should have been in the plane here. So, ferromagnet magnetization is out of the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And then I look at the spin flux, which is in the plane. So what I should have plotted here, I should have plotted the induced spin flux component in the plane.
Mx or
My. So it's this coordinate there, which I have there, which is incorrect. Sorry about that. But good question, because it was confusing. Yeah.
Z is still in the plane. It's just this is Mx.
Okay. Or set. Yeah. Or I could turn my set axis and then yeah. Okay. So the point is that the induced spin accumulation perpendicular to the magnetization, that is the one that starts to oscillate and which leads to defacing. Okay, so this length is then very small because it's of the scale of the Fermi wavelength, which means that this happens essentially at the interface in a system which is more than a couple of lattice constants thickness. So if we look at this at a, let's say, a little larger scale, what happens is that we send in this spin polarized current, which can have any direction from the normal metal here, which and this is created by some other source, part of the circuit, into this ferromagnet. And then since we have incoherence of the up and down spin electron states in the ferromagnet, then we can only have spin current in the ferromagnet, which is aligned to the magnetization. So that means that at the interface, there is a loss of spin flux or spin current at the interface. And this difference between what we actually sent in and what comes out on the other side will be transferred to the order parameter of the magnet itself, unless in the case that there is no other sources of spin flip or coupling to the lattice, for instance. So that means that this difference, which you can then write as the difference between these two currents, or the magnitude of the current times this cross product, will be transmitted to the ferromagnet. So that happens at the interface. But if now the ferromagnet, if the ferromagnet is stiff enough, then this torque will be then transmitted to the whole ferromagnet. So you can rotate the ferromagnet as a whole. So that means that if we now go back to the dynamics of this single ferromagnet, then we had for an isolated ferromagnet, we had these three terms. Then if we now drive this ferromagnet by this spin polarized current, one gets this additional term, which is the term that Schnulsiski first wrote down. And so this is the extra term. And I will now also probably mention that there are also some other additional terms which are relevant in some regimes, which are some terms that do not only depend on the current itself, but they could be the derivatives of currents or derivatives of the magnetization. And by having this term into the dynamics for the ferromagnet, one can now drive this ferromagnet, one can have induced a reversal process, or one can start to have excitations in terms of precessions of this ferromagnet. Now, let me describe one way when we can actually calculate this spin transfer torque based on the microscopic details at this interface. Because now we know that this spin transfer torque, that is an interface phenomenon, so we have to understand now what happens between the normal metal and the ferromagnet in order to quantify this effect. So then we know from mesoscopic physics that what you do is you set up a scattering matrix for this interface. And in this case, this scattering matrix is, as usual, it's a matrix in the base of the waveguide modes, but it's also a matrix in spin space in this case. And then if there are no spin flips in the system, one can always project out up and down components, which are kind of aligned and anti-aligned to the magnetization. And if one does so, one naturally gets what we like to call magneto-electronic circuit theory for how the transport between the normal metal and the ferromagnet happens through this interface. So let's consider this is now a normal metal, and this is any kind of interface between the normal metal and the ferromagnet, and let's assume that we have some charge potential and a spin potential at this normal metal, and let's assume that we just have a charge potential on the ferromagnet side. I can include a spin potential there also, but it doesn't really lead to so much interesting things. So now the question is, what is now the charge current and spin current going through this interface based on, or in response to these potentials? So it turns out that if you now do this exercise with the scattering matrices, one will find that, first of all, there are two components of the current. One is in the direction of the magnetization, which is like a spin-up conductance, which we know very well from the old history of GMR effects. So that's the component, the conductance for the spins that are aligned to the magnetization, which is the charge plus the component of the spin accumulation, which is aligned to the magnetization, minus the charge here, that's which drives this. And similarly, one has for the down component. And the particle current is just the sum of the two. That's the trace of those two components. The interesting part of what's being driven between those two systems is the spin current. And the spin current will now have components. First of all, we'll have a component which is in the direction of the magnetization of the ferromagnet. But there can also be components that are perpendicular to this direction if I now evaluate the spin current on the normal metal side, because this spin accumulation can be any direction, so it can also have components that are perpendicular to the magnetization. So first of all, one finds that there is a contribution to the spin current, or which is in the direction of the magnetization, which is just the difference between these two components. This is the difference between the current polarized in the direction of magnetization and the opposite. But then the interesting terms are the ones that are perpendicular to this, because these are the terms that do not exist on the ferromagnet side. These are terms that will vanish because of this incoherence, and these are the terms that will be the spin transfer torque, which actually drives the magnetization. Yep.
And what is DNS? It's a drop on the interface voltage curve.
DNS, so what I consider here, okay, this is the interface, this green, and then I consider I have some, just for simplicity now, I have a huge normal metal node, and in that node is not in equilibrium, so I have charge potential, this VCN, and then the VSN is the spin accumulation potential, so it's both a magnitude and a direction of the spin accumulation potential. And this is set up by other parts of the circuit, which I would have to deal with at a later stage. So what we see here is that there are two components to that current, the spin current, which are perpendicular to the magnetization, and they are driven by this accumulation of norm metal here. So these are the terms that will drive the dynamics of the magnetization. And one can find microscopic equation for these additional conductances which drive these spin transfer torque currents. And this conductance is almost like a normal conductance for spin up and spin down electrons, except that it kind of couples up and down. And that doesn't mean that there's no spin flip going on here, but this just means that it's the perpendicular component. So this is the linear combinations of up and down spin in that basis. Okay, based on Luc Pechere's, not based on this prediction, of course, but this was much later, but maybe based on Luc Pechere's and John Slifczynski's predictions, these kinds of excitations in spin walls have been seen now in many types of experiments, where typically, first of all, one saw just reversal of, in this case, the thin layer state. So one has one thick layer which polarizes the current, and then one looks at the effect of the spin polarized current on the thin layer. So let me just show you some of all the experimental activity which has been going on this. And a lot of activity happens at Cornell, but also there is activity at NYU, IBM, and initially there was a lot of activity at Lausanne. And Michigan State University is also doing a lot of these kinds of experiments, and also in Paris, and probably also other groups. And most of these experiments can be explained in terms of a macrospin description of the thin layer ferromagnet, meaning that the whole ferromagnet rotates coherently. Now, I'm going to, since this is about current induced effects in domain walls, I'm now going to talk a little about spin waves. So let's imagine that we just have a single ferromagnetic layer and one normal metal, and still we have this kind of layered structure. Then Polyansky and Brouwer, they show that even if you just have a single layer, you can have excitations of the magnetization in a single layer. You don't need two layers. You don't need one layer to polarize the current and another to study the effects of that polarization. One layer is enough. And this can be understood in the following way. Okay, so initially, when you have a single layer, and if this layer has a fixed magnetization direction, then you will polarize the current. But since you have polarized the current in the same direction as the magnetization, there will be no spin transfer torque initially. So what you have to do is you have to study what happens if there's now a small instability. So let's say that there is a small instability in this ferromagnet, and for simplicity, let's say that the ferromagnet breaks up into two domains. Then one has to study, will this situation now be stable when I pass a current through it, or it will be unstable? And so what happens now if you now break this into two domains, then you can have the situation that one spin from one of the domains, it diffuses into normal metal and comes back into the other domain. And when it comes into the other domain, the spin direction of that electron will not be aligned to the other domain's magnetization direction. So that means that in principle there can now be a spin transfer torque between those two domains. And this is what happens. But this does not happen in equilibrium, because in equilibrium all these currents will average each other out, so there is no spin transfer torque. It only happens if you now drive a current through the system, And it turns out that this instability then only happens with one current direction, just like it is the case for the macrospin excitations. And these kinds of excitations have also been seen experimentally by at least two groups. And now it's quite obvious, I guess, that if you now go back to look at these spin valves, which is the devices that are mostly being studied in this field, there should be in principle be not just this macrospin excitations I talked to begin with, but since we know that even a single layer in itself can have spin wave excitations, it means that a spin wall which consists of two ferromagnets can have both macrospin and spin wave excitations. And in order to use this for to make use of this for something, let's say a device or something, would like to know what am I actually exciting in such a spin wave? Am I exciting this macrospin excitations, or am I exciting the spin wave excitations? Let me just show how we can see that you have both macrospin and spin wave excitations in an experiment. So this is an experiment which is done at New York University and IBM. So they have made a structure out of copper and cobalt. So these are the copper layers and these are the cobalt layers, and they have one thin and one thick layer, but the thick one is not really very much thicker than the other, it's four times thicker than the other, and in this case this turns out to be important. And what they study in order to see if you have excitations or not is they study the deposit current through here, and they measure the differential voltage across the system. So if they do that, they see as a function now of bias, they see for positive currents, they see some peaks in this DVDI characteristics. And for negative currents, they're at this scale, they see nothing. But if they blow this picture up, then you see that around 10, okay, sorry, this is a function of current, around 10 milliampere, you see these peaks, these big peaks, which are interpreted in terms of the macrospin excitations. And the reason why they are interpreted in terms of macrospin excitations, the reason is that the difference in resistance on the, let's say, right-hand side and the left-hand side here is corresponding to the difference in resistance you have between a parallel and an anti-parallel alignment in the linear response regime for much smaller currents when you just use an external magnetic field to switch the layers. So that's why they interpret this as really being macrospin excitations here for positive currents.
Why do you call it instability? It's just switching.
Yeah, okay, so yeah, it's a switching that happens. Yeah. Well, okay, so the reason I call it instability is that if you look at it and calculate it, which we have done, which I will not describe actually, then you'll find that at these currents there is an instability, but it's an instability for the qequals zero mode, meaning that there is an instability towards macrospin excitations. But what actually happens after that instability, it's much harder to tell theoretically, because then you have to go beyond linear a response, but the experimental interpretation is that it actually switches. But that description is more complicated than the simplest model would describe. Yeah. Now, for negative currents, they see some tiny features at some points, and they're quite different than what you see for positive currents, because the you can see the resistance doesn't go up; it actually goes down. And this can be understood that typically when you in a such a spin valve system, if you add spin flips in the system in some sense, then usually the current goes up because you have more links between spin up and spin down channels. And if you break up a single domain into many domains, you typically have couplings between more kinds of spin channels, so typically the conductance goes up. So the experimental interpretation is that these are due to spin wave excitations for negative currents. And then the bottom line here That's just the dispersion of these curves as a function of external magnetic field. And how do they change in an external magnetic field? And the same is for the other curves down there for these spinning waves. And these experiments were done at the high magnetic field. And the advantages of doing this at the high magnetic field is that then your external field is hopefully larger than the demagnetization field in the systems, because that's another regime again for the dynamics.
So spin wave instability is essentially something that happens in spatial instability.
Yeah, so that this is a right. So this and if you calculate it, that turns out that you actually do get that the ferromagnet, the macrospin breaks up into spin waves. You will have spin wave excitations for these negative currents in this geometry. So in this, these two are both in the thin layer. They have some additional interesting features here. If you go to even after it switches, presumably from the parallel to the antiparallel configuration, if you go to even higher currents, you actually see additional features, which I didn't high up here, let's say. And these are, it turns out, to be excitations in the thick layer. Spin wave excitations in the thick layer, which we can also model.
There is no simultaneous instability.
In principle, there could be. This depends on the parameters, kind of, and the thickness of the layers, and which controls kind of the critical currents for the onset of these excitations.
I'm
yep.
Sure this point, your explanation about the definition of the macrospin instability and this new.
Okay, so the definition of the macrospin instability is that the whole the magnetization is being excited as a uniform. It's a uniform excitation in the magnet.
The finite Q or Q equals zero.
Q equals zero. Macrospin, and then if there's any finite Q, then I call it a spin wave excitation.
And in these experiments, are the Qs in the current direction or transverse direction?
This is in the transverse direction.
In all experiments.
Well, okay, so, well, in this experiment, it's most likely transfer, at least for the this thin layer, because the longitudinal excitations are much higher in energy. But for this thick layer, there could be some longitudinal component as well, I think. But the estimate is that this thick layer is really at the borderline of where these longitudinal excitations can come into play. Because the reason is that my picture is slightly misleading, so actually the length here is much larger than the length in this direction, so it costs a lot of energy to excite along the current direction. Yeah.
So can you give a general criteria when this macrospin model works?
Yeah. So we have done a theory of that, but I didn't want to explain it because it gets.
In few words, you can't. Can you put it?
In few words, I can say that if the system is completely symmetric, you will only have macrospin excitations. If it's asymmetric, you will induce spin waves excitations.
Asymmetric laterally.
Laterally, in the current direction, yeah. It depends on the symmetry, yeah.
And do Oersted fields sort of generically do that, or?
Oh, Oersted fields is not included in that analysis, so that okay. That comes on top, which can induce, yeah. I think I'll just tell maybe one more thing, and then I think I should stop to not make this too long. Okay, so now I talked about spin transfer torque, the driving term that drives the ferromagnet, which is proportional to the steady state current. Now, we know that if we have a ferromagnet, we can excite it by a ferromagnet resonance. And it turns out that if you excite such a ferromagnet, if it precesses in time, then when you attach this ferromagnet to another conductor, let's say a normal metal, then this excitation of the ferromagnet will induce spin currents into this adjacent normal metal. And this was actually understood already from the 70s by some experiments on electron spin resonance, I think it was, by these people. And what we did later was to formulate a microscopic theory for how the quantity, how large is the spin current which is being excited into the normal metals. And it turns out that this the amount of current that you excite into the adjacent normal metals is determined by the same quantity that determines the spin transfer torque. So this is kind of like an inverse effect again of the spin transfer torque. And I will now try to explain this formula, and I think that's the last thing I'll do before I stop. Let's assume that we now take the completely unrealistic assumption that the ferromagnet now rotates completely. So it really goes in a circle. So I have the extreme precession limit. So the magnetization is rotating with some frequency omega. Then I can, in a simple limit, calculate that this pumped current, the spin current which is driven out of the ferromagnet, it is proportional to this frequency of the rotation of the ferromagnet, and it's proportional to the number of transverse waveguide modes, the number of transverse channels, and then we have h bar half. That's the angular momentum which is carried by each mode. So how can we understand this result? Now, let's say this is my normal metal, so I have all states filled up to the Fermi energy, and this is the ferromagnet, which is now in contact to this normal metal. So what happens is that an electron which is below the Fermi energy can come from this normal metal, and it comes to the ferromagnet, it can flip its spin and pick up H omega energy and go back. And this process, since I have n conducting channels between them, I will have this n transfer times, and this is my driving energy which can drive this process, and this is the amount of angular momentum carried by each one of these electrons. So that's how we can understand.
Yeah. The spin is rotated in x-y direction, and you are talking about the spin current or the direction?
Let's see. So. So the spin current is perpendicular to this rotation. It's in the same direction as the driving field of the magnet would be. So actually what happens is that the angular momentum which you get into normal metal is taken from the external magnetic field. That's your source of angular momentum. I'll just finally say what the consequence of this is. If you now have, if you have one ferromagnet which processes in contact with normal metal, then if there's no spin dissipation in normal metal, you can then create a spin battery because you will pump spins into normal metal, and after some time you will build up a spin accumulation in normal metal which will diffuse back. So you'll reach some kind of steady state condition where you can then find out what is now the amount of spins in the normal metal, and typically then the spin potential you will get is then H bar omega maximum effect, because that's the maximum energy you can drive in. Now if the spins relax in the normal metal, they will be lost, they will never come back, but the ferromagnet will feel the fact that some angular momentum is being lost into the normal metal, so that feeds back onto the ferromagnet dynamics, so it will be an enhanced Gilbert damping onto the ferromagnet. And that enhancement is then proportional to the interface area, and because that's the larger area you have, the more spins flow out. But on the other hand, it will be inversely proportional to the area, the volume of the ferromagnet itself, because the larger ferromagnet you have, the less it will feel the fact that some spins are being lost. So this is an effect which is important for thin film ferromagnets in contact with normal metals. And then if you have two ferromagnets in contact to each other, then one can process independently and the other can be static, then you will have dissipation which depends on the relative orientation of these angles, because we know that in the second ferromagnet it's only the spins that are perpendicular to this magnetization direction that will be lost. The others will not be lost. And finally, if both of them start to process, you can have a spin transfer from one to the other, and they start dynamically to talk to each other, and you can have kind of like acoustic and optical excitation modes of these two ferromagnets. I think I'll stop there. And then.
A very question.
Yep.
For spin injection, critical is non-equilibrium distribution at the spin diffusion rates. One in pure science, was mentioned only as applied to spin dynamics. And all the spin dynamics does not depend on this non-equilibrium spin distribution at the diffusion level.
Okay, so I didn't tell, but we have also done, there's also more complicated experiments in theory. You can also study, let's say you have a ferromagnet and then a norm metal with a given spin diffusion length, and then you can study the FMR line width as a function of length versus spin diffusion length. So you can actually study kind of crossover when the norm metal is longer than and or shorter than the spin diffusion length. I'm not sure if that...
Actually, all the equations which you wrote were applicable to the case when was arbitrary for shorter than spin diffusion length,
yes,
or longer than spin diffusion length. Are there such kind of restrictions in this
theory? The restriction of the theory is that it's essentially it's a semi-classical theory. So first of all, the systems have to be like confirmed by everyone. That's one.
But it also kind of means that some subject should be larger than the metric path. But
mean three paths, but spin diffusion lengths.
Right. So you can
does it enter into theory or not?
It does enter if I now do a bit more complicated story and include it in what happens on the norm metal side, which I did not include in my talk.
Systems included normal metals.
So what I talked about mostly was what happened at the interface. So if I would like to include the spin diffusion, I would have to now involve the spin diffusion equation in norm metal, which we can do, and we have done. So that can help with that.
Okay, so let me take over, and I'll talk about current-driven dynamics in a continuous limit when we're dealing just with a single ferromagnet. And let me acknowledge my collaborators, Arne Brattas, Garrett Brattas, his brother, evil brother, and Hans Joachim, he's a student of Arne at Trondheim. Okay, so let me just summarize on one slide what Arne has told and what I will be using in my talk. Okay, so Arne described very nicely that spin-polarized electrons impinging on a ferromagnet transfer angular momentum to some kind of macrospin or some kind of more complicated collector magnetization dynamics of the ferromagnet. And what's important is the separation of energy scales. Basically, and I should point out, first of all, as Alan described us yesterday, if you get ferromagnets, you typically get ferromagnets with large exchange energy. If you get instability, it's really significant magnetic instability. So, and that's what I will be assuming in my talk, that the exchange energy in the ferromagnet is larger than any other relevant energy scale, such as transport-related energy scales and the spin orbit energy scale, etc. Because of this, the electrons which enter the ferromagnet, they process very, very rapidly, experiencing huge exchange splitting, and therefore you can treat this spin transfer adiabatically. So basically, the magnetization responds very slowly, typically on the microwave in the microwave range. So any dynamics that the spin transfer induces, which is conventionally described by this Landau-Lipschitz formalism, is very slow on the scale of the spin transfer processes. So basically, as a first approximation, you can treat the spin transfer instantaneously and then describe magnetization dynamics as some very slow response, and that's what I will be doing also for continuous dynamics. And as Arne described, the spin torque due to the spin transfer physics can have dramatic consequences for magnetic dynamics in the heterostructures, leading to all sorts of instabilities, which are very interesting from a fundamental point of view. And also, actually, what Arne didn't tell you is that they are very promising for applications such as memories, storage and memory. And the seminal ideas were formulated in 1996 by Slonczewski and Bergeron. All right. So I will tell you about extension of these ideas or generalization to continuous dynamics. And similarly to heterostructures, you can, you know, as a first approximation, you can assume that electrons moving through some kind of self-consistent exchange field, because the exchange field is huge, they more or less align with the magnetization, and any kind of theory you develop assuming the exchange is large would have this, the dominant term in the theory would be spin transfer due to simply realigning of the electrons with the exchange field. And you know, what's important is that when the magnetization is inhomogeneous, then that spin and orbit degrees of freedom are coupled, and that's why, you know, when you drive currents through the system in general, you can excite some magnetic dynamics because orbital motion and spin dynamics are coupled. And so first of all, I should point out that in heterostructures, you know, this kind of along the lines that Anne was telling us, the physics is very well established. We have very good agreement between theory, between experiments, between ab initio calculations for this for metallic materials. There are some remaining questions for semiconductors with transition orbit, but still that area is quite well established. As I'll show you, this continuous dynamics is kind of more messy, at least as in, sort of, on the scale of the magneto-electronic community. People disagree what's happening, and I will try to basically summarize what other people are saying and point out the disagreements, and we'll present sort of our view. And again, our view is also some kind of baby steps. We really try to do things kind of from very basic starting point. And all of these theories that I will describe are some kind of mean field theories where magnetization is described completely classically as just some kind of you know, exchange field due to either localized D electrons or in a Stoner model. And one of the important conclusions that we make, which surprised us actually, that for dynamic phenomena, it's very important if you start with SD model or Stoner model. That's going to be one of my important conclusions. And you typically wind up if you... Okay, so the general idea is that you have some kind of classical exchange field, time and position dependent, and you want to describe quantum mechanically some electron response in this exchange field. Eventually, you have the electrons moving in this exchange field are in general somehow misaligned with the magnetization and exert torque back on the magnetic dynamics. So the first step, you describe, derive some kind of equation of motion for the conducting spins, you know, which process in some effective field H, you know, generate magnetic dynamics or a current driven through the system, generate some spin currents, which divergence of which also affects magnetic dynamics. And importantly, if you include spin orbit scattering, some spin orbit disorder in the system, or some kind of magnetic disorder, you will always have spin dephasing, which is important for spin dynamics of conducting electrons. And after you solve this problem for some self-consistent exchange field, you have to calculate the sort of back action of this electron response on the ferromagnet. And again, you do it in a mean field fashion, just calculate torques back on the magnetization, and that gives you kind of self-consistent description. So I'm not saying that's the way it should be done. That's the way it's done now. Okay. So, and I'll just try to basically describe you the progress people have done. Okay, so first of all, theoretically, we heard two very nice talks by Stuart Parkin and Hideo Ono on current-induced domain wall motion in metals and magnetic semiconductors. The first actually experiment, a systematic experiment on single domain motion was done by Yamaguchi a couple of years ago. They used a nanomagnetic nanowire of this L-shaped magnetic nanowire, pretty macroscopic, like a few microns long, and they injected domain. First of all, you could inject domain walls, create domain walls just with external magnetic field, and you could inject domain walls into the wire from a diamond-shaped pad shown here, and then in this end, domain walls would just kind of disappear. You would never, you could never inject domain, so it's kind of like a sink of domain walls. So you could easily, with just as magnetic fields, create a single domain wall and sort of applying a magnetic field in a particular direction. You could trap a domain wall at this bending corner. And after you do that, you start basically monitoring. So basically you can see this domain wall on the some kind of microscope. And basically, you can then drive the current through the wire. And they saw that if they drive current into the right, then domain wall moves to the left, and vice versa. If you drive the current to the left, domain wall moves to the right. So that that indicates spin transfer physics. And indeed, qualitatively, they could understand the domain wall motion roughly in the consistently with what theories tell. And on the theories, on a very sort of rough qualitative level, it's kind of obvious that as you drive spins through the system, through a domain wall, the electron spins flip basically they change the orientation. And therefore, there is an angular momentum transfer to the domain wall, and that has to be absorbed by the ferromagnet. And basically, if you assume a perfect conversion of spin angular momentum from conducting electrons to the domain wall, the distance the domain wall moves is proportional to the number of electrons you pass through, just conservation of angular momentum. And okay, the direction of the motion of the main wall again is just consistent with what you expect from some conversion of angular momentum. And in practice, they didn't see you don't see perfect conversion of the angular momentum. There is some dissipation. So the velocity, okay, so they measured velocity as a function of current density. It was sort of in the ballpark of what people are calculating, I don't know, after an order of magnitude or so. You know, then of course, this theoretical discussion hits up once you start looking into details. That's when you see that although on a very rough level we understand things more or less, you know, actually the details still elude a complete theoretical understanding. And all of the physics in this system is actually kind of in the details, as I'll show. All right, so let me briefly describe the theories. There are several theories. They all start from essentially exactly the same Hamiltonian. So they SD theories. They start from basically Heisenberg Hamiltonian for D electrons, coupled which are coupled to conducting S electrons through exchange interaction, and you know, you cannot solve and then you drive currents through the system. You have to make some approximations to solve it, and as I told you, you do mean field approximations. People do different kinds of mean field approximations, and in particular, people basically, besides mean field approximation, the equation is still complicated. You have to derive some kind of effective equation for the motion of the domain wall. So, from this complicated system, you want to describe just this complicated process. You want to describe just by very few dynamic variables, and typically it's basically position of the domain wall and let's say some angular coordinate of the domain wall that describes roughly what kind of domain wall distorts as you apply current. And people do different kind of approximations and get very different, actually completely qualitatively different predictions. So let me just summarize what are the results that people are getting. Okay, first of all, there is a paper by Tatara and Kono on this topic. First of all, they point out that as you drive currents through the main wall, there are two important contributions to the two important terms that drive the main wall motion. First is this kind of adiabatic spin transfer torque, and secondly, there is momentum transfer term. And the spin transfer torque dominates for smooth domain walls, and for very sharp domain walls, the momentum transfer is important, and momentum transfer term is directly proportional to the wall resistance. So, you know, in the adiabatic approximation, wall resistance is zero, and that's when spin transfer physics dominates. And it's actually, I think people, most people agree that that's the most relevant regime. The momentum transfer term is important only for extremely sharp domain walls, sharp on the scale of atomic spacing, basically. So for typical kind of domain walls, which are pretty smooth, the spin transfer term dominates. And what Tatara gets is that as you drive current, first of all, nothing happens until you reach some kind of critical current. And so basically current slightly distorts domain, but there is no motion. And after the critical current, there is, the velocity grows in this form, as a so eventually it grows linearly with a current. And the critical this critical current is has intrinsic contribution. So even in the absence of any disorder, any pinning, Tatara says that there is still some critical current. Nothing happens before you hit the critical current. And pinning will further enhance the critical current. Another paper by Barnes and Mikawa says that, in fact, again, starting from actually the same microscopic Hamiltonian, but doing some slightly different approximation, they get there's no intrinsic pinning. So basically, there's no disorder, the domain wall starts moving immediately as you turn on the current. And the pinning, all pinning comes from the from an extrinsic potential. And when you overcome some pinning threshold, the velocity grows linearly beyond the threshold current. And this prefactor is would correspond to sort of this perfect conversion of electron spin into the domain wall angular momentum. Okay, and they say okay, the results sort of this actually turns out to agree roughly with the experiment. And but I think it just shows that we need more experiments. Okay, and finally there is this nice paper by Jean and Lee where basically the important contribution of this paper is not domain wall motion necessarily, but rather deriving basic equation of motion for the ferromagnet. And so they basically the main part is this Landau-Lifshitz plus they put in by hand the Gilbert damping. Then there is this third term is this spin transfer torque adiabatic spin transfer torque, assuming that conducting spins align perfectly with exchange, and that's what everybody else is getting. And then finally they got this new term which is proportional to. Proportional to spin dephasing, spin dephasing of electrons. So that comes from some kind of spin orbit disorder in the system. And they showed that without this, and this term is very small in comparison to this adiabatic term, torque, it's just a small correction. But without this term, you get no domain wall motion for low currents. But including this this term, you get domain wall motion for very small currents, and the velocity will be proportional to the current. So basically, it's very, very important. It turns out, in their paper, which I basically agree that it's very important to include this kind of small terms which come to due to corrections to the adiabatic spin torque. Due to some disorder, magnetic disorder, or spin orbit impurities. Okay, so here's our contribution to this mess, basically. We're not trying to clear up where people are wrong or correct in their approximations. We rather derive our own theory, of course. And we say, okay, let's. Basically, our contribution is twofold. First, we say, let's start from the most basic. Level, in this paper, for example, they start from the level of diffusion equation, and I don't think they treat correctly the transverse spin component, which is the key here. We basically start from the level of kinetic equation, so just the most basic. Especially we start microscopically and derive the Boltzmann equation from the kinetic equation, and doing kind of well-controlled approximations using Keldysh formalism. We basically agree with Jean and Lee. except for one important, again, the other contribution that we're making is that we're saying we want to consider actually itinerant ferromagnets rather than SD. So again, it's a self-consistent Minfield theory, but the magnetization comes from the electrons themselves, not due to some D electrons. So we do we use Tonne model rather than SD. In fact, we can calculate SD in the fashion, and we actually surprisingly we get the same result. Although I think some of the steps are kind of not very convincing, but we did reproduce the result for SD, and but we're most interested in the Tonne model because we feel it's kind of maybe more relevant for the transition metals. So we want to develop the self-consistent description. It's in, you know, basically density functional theory, but we do LDA approximation. Okay, in principle, the starting point is exact, it's correct, and then of course we make some basic approximations. But I think this is kind of the way to go if you want to describe transitional metal ferromagnets in principle. Okay, so I have maybe like 5 minutes left, so let me not go into detail, but basically domain wall motion is one very interesting aspect of current-driven dynamics in ferromagnets. Another one is current-driven instabilities in the bulk. That's another topic that has been explored within this SD model, and everybody basically agrees that when you drive current, there is Doppler shift, which leads to instabilities. And that's correct in SD model, but it turns out once you do a self-consistent theory based on Stoner model, there are no instabilities actually, at least at on the level of this kind of approximation. So you have to go to some kind of more complicated maybe nonlinear corrections to get instabilities. There are no instabilities at this level of approximation that people have been dealing before. Basically, at low currents, there is no instability for Stoner model. That's one prediction that we make. And again, you know, it's theoretically another controversial question is what happens beyond instability. You know, some people say there is some kind of a new effective ground state, because at least the dominant spin transfer torque, this adiabatic spin transfer torque, can be included in free energy, effective free energy of the ferromagnet. So you may think if that effective free energy has minimum, then the system, you know, if described by Landau-Lifshitz-Gilbert equation, has no choice as to go to that minimum. And that's kind of this period that Tatara and collaborators are thinking in. But it's not obvious, at least to me, that free energy has a minimum, you know, because it's not really, it's not a thermodynamic free energy, it's just some kind of effective free energy that gives correct equation of motion. And maybe that's why, you know, Li and Zhang, when they do numerical magnetic modeling, and they get chaotic behavior beyond instability. So it's not, at least mathematically, I think it's a basic question. I don't know the answer, maybe somebody knows. Does that free energy has a minimum mathematically? Okay. Do you know? That current-driven free energy, does it have a minimum? Does it have ground state? So that's one basic question, basically. And, you know, if it is, then this is definitely wrong. Maybe you have to think in this kind of Tatara way and think of really look for complicated multi-domain ground states beyond instability. But anyways, it's an open question. Basically, what happens beyond instability? Now, so this is the summary of the basic theoretical questions. The critical current for domain wall motion and for bulk instabilities, what is it? Is it zero? Is it finite? Is it mostly extrinsic, intrinsic? It's not clear. Okay, I'll give answer to this briefly to this question within our theory, but I still think that more work is necessary to understand it completely. Then domain wall velocity beyond the critical current, what is it again? How does it grow with the driving current? Domain wall deformation, another question which is unclear. Then current-driven instabilities in the bulk. Okay, what happens beyond instability? It's chaotic behavior or some kind of multi-domain ground state. And once you start thinking of these issues, and I'll show you to make this complicated, details matter. Like in a way, details in the sense that, you know, do you use SD model or Stoner model? And the small terms in the small corrections to this dominant adiabatic torque are the ones that actually determine this macroscopic behavior. So when you really want to answer this question, turns out, in the end of the day, you have to go to the bare basics of the magnetism, of the dynamics in magnetism. And you really have to understand Hilbert damping. That's something we tried to avoid for many years. You can think of some kind of a logical parameter, but you really have to understand basics of magnetic dynamics, in order to understand this macroscopic behavior. Okay, let me skip this. So first of all, I just want to say that you can gain a lot of insights from circuit theory, even for this bulk dynamics. Okay, so this is a Stoner model, basically some kind of density functional Hamiltonian that describes electrons, and we do LDA approximation. Okay, so let me skip this. That's just to flash you the kinetic equation you have to deal with. It's complicated because you have to. It's not a linear kinetic equation because you want to describe interplay current drift and magnetic dynamics. So it has to be non-linear in a current. Basically, you have to describe magnetic dynamics on top of already non-equilibrium drifting distribution. So there are all sorts of terms, but they're all transparent. They all have a very clear physical meaning. Let me not go into detail. Luckily, in the diffusion equation, many of them cancel. Just and some symmetry that has to be satisfied. And there is a little controversy, I guess, now that how do you include spin defacing? That's the key. The spin defacing determines the Gilbert damping and determines turns out everything. All of these macroscopic things like domainable motion and instabilities. And we first just put it by hand as some kind of phonological parameter in the kinetic equation. And recently, Stiles and collaborator complained that this is incorrect. Nothing like that should be present. And basically, he had a point that if you put it by hand, you really have to justify it. And we did justify it recently. So basically, we derived such terms from from microscopic Hamiltonian for spin orbit disorder and also for magnetic disorder. You generically get spin defacing. Of this form, basically locally, just like just like usual scattering in your kinetic equation, locally electrons try to equilibrate to the local exchange field, and that's key.
The
he feels strongly about it, but in their paper they don't really include spin orbit interactions, so it's completely hand waving argument, and I cannot. I have to talk to him before I say something too strong. But anyways, I think we do kind of everything rigorously in a way, like on the level of gradient expansion and some perturbation theory and Born approximation.
This is also the point, and we have this conversation with the Tatara scaling of the velocity versus the current because they don't include the...
Oh, that's right, yeah. So anyway, spin orbit is the key, and we derive an equation of motion of the magnetization dynamics. This is the usual Landau-Lipschitz-Gilbert part, and then that's the current-driven term. And everything here is calculated from this microscopic Hamiltonian. So alpha is determined. The Gilbert damping is also determined by this spin defacing, which comes from spin orbit or magnetic disorder. And there are differences. In LDA, alpha is simply beta, which is this normalized spin defacing rate. Delta is the exchange field. In SD model, it's slightly different. There's a prefactor here, and this eta is basically the fraction of angular momentum contained in S electrons with respect to the total angular momentum. So that's the only difference between LDA and SD. But that's turns out extremely important difference once you solve this equation. And then again, beta comes in here. This is this one here is just the adiabatic spin transfer torque. Then beta is a small correction. Small because I assume that delta is the largest energy in comparison to everything else. So just in the theory, beta is small. I think in practice, it's small. Plus, there is a small dynamic correction. Sort of kind of like usually you have in your equation of motion heterostructures, you always get some dynamic spin pumping corrections, this kind of thing in the spirit. First of all, I want to say that if you solve if you solve this equation without, okay, without this term, the Doppler shift leads to instabilities in the ferromagnet. With this term, if alpha equals beta in LDA for Stoner model, there is no instability. This equation doesn't have small excitations of magnetization. Don't lead to any instabilities if magnetization described by this equation. That's kind of that's surprising. Okay, but so okay, that's just a mathematical statement. And then okay, there is a small dynamic correction, and usually it's really small for everything we looked at, not important. I want to say that this dominant torque is analogous to the spin transfer torque, which is proportional to real part of mechanical conductance, and the small corrections is proportional to imaginary torque is proportional to imaginary part of mechanical conductance in this circuit theory. Okay, and if you look at the manual motion, once again you find that okay, so this is using this trick of Li and Zhang, basically based on Walker's ansatz, you find that for small currents, the main wall initially, if you apply a current pulse, it moves as if predicted by a perfect with a velocity that proportional to current, with no critical threshold. Just right away, it starts moving, and this prefact is again just 100% conversion, corresponds to 100% conversion of spin angular momentum into magnetic moment, and it turns out that the wall starts deforming a little bit and it changes velocity. And it changes velocity by the factor of beta over alpha. And again, LDA, beta equals to alpha, so turns out the main wall moves as if there was no spin defacing, as if, very surprisingly, somehow these two torques interplay in such a way that the main wall velocity still is given by what you would naively expect from a perfect conversion of spin angular momentum. So that's something kind of surprising. And I should point out that this is without any macroscopic pinning. Clearly, if you have some kind of complicated profile, then the main will be pinned. This is just for this kind of you know, microscopic disorder, spin orbit disorder, and magnetic disorder. If you can include pinning in the effective field, of course, still using this equation for macroscopic pinning. P, okay, is just a prefact which describes, you know, how electrons are polarized by exchange field. Okay, I should point out that there are some cancellations when you look at the deformation of the main wall, and it turns out that again the main wall deformation, the dominant term is this, and when beta equals alpha, again this is zero, and the deformation, there is no basic deformation apart from a small correction, which actually was a different sign, this correction is due to dynamic term. So the deformation for Stoner model is like three orders of magnitude smaller than deformation predicted for SD model, and so basically it's negligible. Like it's really really tiny. There's almost no deformation. That actually makes this Walker ansatz even much much better. So it's actually it's more reliable approximation.
Alpha, I think, that the beta constant, the velocity is just constant all the time.
It's initial is equal to final. Maybe there's some slight, yeah. But basically, it's constant, yeah. Okay, so this is sorry, I took a few minutes longer. These are the conclusions. So first of all, the main thing is that current-driven magnetization dynamics in bulk needs more attention, especially experimentally. There are really not so many experiments that constrain these theories. We pointed out a qualitative difference for SD model and Stoner model. It's sort of on the level of parameters, but the consequences are dramatic for macroscopic manifestations of this spin transfer torques. And it's really important to understand the origin of ferromagnetic damping, like where this alpha and beta, where they come from. We of course made some serious approximations to derive these equations, and I'm not so sure, basically that what we're missing actually by this single electron defacing approximation seems reasonable, if you believe LDA fully, but I'm not sure what are the corrections to this, and that's certainly important, I think, for all of these things that we calculate. So in the end of the day, the question is, what's the correct description of magnetism in transition metals? Is Stoner model, SD model more appropriate? And current-driven dynamics appears to be very sensitive to these very basic questions of magnetism. Okay, thank you.
If to try to say it in a simple way, actually the domain wall is the motion of the domain wall is a zero mode, because the energy does not change when the boundary moves. So what could be the mechanisms of pinning?
Oh, so the pinning is just some effective field.
Is it something microscopic at the scale of one or two lattice spacing? So it should be absent in the macroscopic theory and present only in the microscopic theory, or extrinsic theory?
Okay, so we don't get any microscopic pinning. So, and I'm not. I don't want.
Microscopic theory in a perfect system should give
no pinning.
No pinning.
Yeah, that's what we find. Yeah.
And no threshold current.
That's right. Yeah.
No threshold current.
That's right.
So you said that you can also describe a z-model by your model. So what is really universal in your model, so you can actually go from itinerant electrons to a z-model?
Yeah, so because it's mean field, right? So the main calculation is electron response in some self-consistent exchange field. So like 99% of calculation, I don't really care if it's SD or Stoner, just some kind of self-consistent, it's single electron response and self-consistent exchange field, right? And then at the end of the day, you say, okay, how do you do self-consistency between electron response and the total magnetic response? You know, look.
Different from beta in
the
SD model?
That's just, you know, why not? That's what you get.
You know, even in an SD model, I'm not sure why you write that. The dissipation, unless you invoke some non-electronic mechanism, is via the S electron, let's say.
That's right, yeah.
And so why does it
SD, you get this kind of prefactor, which is the dissipation comes from S electrons, but the magnetic response is mostly dragged by D electrons. D electrons, most inertia is in D electrons, but dissipation is in S electrons. That's why you get prefactor, which is like S electron magnetization divided by this big D electron magnetization. So in LDA model, the total magnetization is responding dephasing in coherent way, kind of in a self-consistent way. There's no kind of bouncing angular momentum between S and D electrons. It's just one species. There's no prefactor, no eta prefactor there. It's just.
These questions are very much at the heart of what's uncertain, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I don't like to make. For me, it's not so obvious that this. I'm not sure if it's a beta term, I guess, is present.
Oh, okay. What I should stress, first of all, is that if you calculate, that's maybe some subtle issue, that, you know, if you calculate spin currents, in the equation model, there's like divergence of spin current term. There is no beta. There is just this term. Everything else cancels out. But you don't get immediately, equation of motion, like this equation, it's, okay, no, not. Like this equation, it doesn't have LLG form right away. You get, in the end of the day, you get more like block-like damping. And you have to make kind of just a mathematical step. So basically, beta is just a mathematical artifact. It doesn't come from any spin currents. That's kind of important. And it's important to calculate these two terms on equal footing from microscopics. It's not enough just to put alpha by hand and calculate divergence of spin currents. There is no beta in divergence of spin currents. But in the end of the day, if you derive LLG equation, microscopically, without putting anything by hand, you get beta as a mathematical.
The beta was the spin relaxation term.
That's right. Yeah. And, yeah. But the equality of them, alpha equals beta, just comes from because we, you do some kind of a mathematical step from block-like equation to get LLG equation. It doesn't reflect any spin current divergence, this beta. Spin current divergence is the same. But it's just you know, this is just this Gilbert term. It first looks more like in linear response, like block term. To get it in Gilbert form, you have to do a little transformation. That's where beta comes from. So maybe that's what Stahl's problem is, that, you know, he thinks that this comes from some kind of spin current gradient, and it's not.
I would like to come back actually to the meaning of the domain model. Mm-hmm. I completely agree with your argument, because I think you know, when you have a continuum theory, you still have actually the possibility to allow the anisotropy constants to vary spatially.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a microscopic defect,
you know, it can be actually... defects definitely can produce spin, right? But in a perfect system,
why can I not assume that you have some microscopic
effect?
Micro.
Because micro is already sufficient to lower the energy locally.
No, definitely. Yeah. If there are defects, right. So there is no zero mode. Well, zero mode exists only in a periodical.
Yeah, but
perfect.
Right, but it's still a zero mode which has a small correction and correction of the
count. Yeah, okay, so what okay, I should say this is a macroscopic equation, you know, where you assume that your domain wall and everything is much, much larger than any kind of this microscopic scales, and you average, you know, the Born approximation, you average over a disorder position. So in extreme macroscopic limit, there will be pinning coming from microscopic defects, but in this kind of continuum theory where you average over this... You could understand, we don't.
Yes, it's not my assumption.
No, it's not. It's just consequence of this equation that we get. There's no.
I think he's talking about something different. You're talking more like you have a modulation of the anisotropy and the microscopic potential.
I think you get if you have a defect, the microscopic.
In this case, it's assumed that everything is uniform.
No, so the model, we have microscopic defect. I mean, there is a particular kind of microscopic defect, which is just magnetic defects, some magnetic defects, and spin orbit. That's it. I'm not saying that any microscopic defect, you know, is
micro.
Sorry, specific kind of microscopic.
Every system will have microscopic defects. So it's a realistic assumption to assume that you don't have intensification.
No, we don't assume it. We just
microscopic defects are included in the equation in the Born approximation. So everything which can include in the Born approximation does not give you pinning.
Yeah. The Born approximation is not sufficient to describe the pinning.
If you have non-uniform,
actually, you know, you should actually go beyond the Born approximation to describe the effect.
Yeah, but now you're turning things around. Eh? Sort of you're saying, okay, I have very strong pinning centers there, which I introduce. Because in these metals, usually, I guess the impurities are weak, they are screened, and I think the Born approximation should be fine.
So, but I think another point is also that it's assumed that that this impurities is uniform, meaning that the average of in this case, it's assumed that the average of the impurity potential is the same all over the sample. But that might not be the case.
Even if that's true, you're putting in some random potential.
Yeah.
So then, any given sample, there will be regions which have
could be very large tails. And then
same thing people looked at in charge density waves or something, deriving the Fukuyama-Lee-Rice equation.
Right.
You have to go beyond Born.
I mean, I'm not making any statements beyond our approximation. That's just the. At this level, I'm saying that there are this kind of issues that we have to figure out. And indeed, you know, details matter. So once you get no effect with Born approximation, you know, you have to go beyond it. Okay.
You know, one thing that's fascinating about these systems in comparison with domain walls is there's some linear limit where these, let's say, equations of motion for a domain wall reduced to an oscillator equation. And I imagine you can derive such a thing formally for charge density wave systems too. But here, actually, Stuart Parkin showed us last week that actually this oscillator of this macroscopic domain law in their experiments had some large Q. You know, they're very well defined oscillations. And I think that's what that's very different phenomenologically. And they might have a better chance of behaving quantum mechanically than something in a charge density way system.
But you know, I just want to say one last thing. Is that there is disagreement on a much more basic level than what you're talking about. You know, once we sort that out, you know, of course, the theory is incomplete.
In the competing point of view, is that it pins because what the current is doing goes into driving the magnetic part of magnetic configuration away from equilibrium, and that provides some pinning, even if things are spatially homogeneous.
That's right, yeah. So there's some, you have to deform wall and, you know, you could imagine there's some kind of barrier that you have to overcome rather than just kind of fall into this thing.
And another question I have here is when you move the main wall, I mean, during the magnetic system, I know that you will excite spin non-linear coupling.
Yeah. That's not captured. That's not, yeah.
That also could actually produce some...
Okay. I'm not saying there is no threshold. I'm sure there is one. I'm just saying it comes from something more complicated than this. That's just my point. Yeah, there is some threshold current, and that we have to sort that out. Yeah.
I can comment on that. There is a sort of a major industry called micromagnetics, and those people, Pierre Ville, for example, he has simulated these equations, including the beta term. To see how indeed everything such a domain wall, not only this one dimensional, very simple model, but also a realistic one, including a vortex if necessary, and see how this moves under the applied current. And then you can also do pinning if you like, you can have roughness at the edges, and then you get very beautiful pictures, which you indeed see that also spin waves are being emitted under the motion and
when they do micromagnetics, they use some kind of equation like this. And the question is, will those corrections, do they enter on this kind of already coarse-grained level as this in the effective field, or there are some microscopic corrections that are not captured by...
But I think first of all, if you make conclusions, want to make conclusions about more complicated stuff, I think you must also not forget about this Walker model and stuff. This is a very, very simplified model, which is probably not realistic to describe experiments, for example.
That's right, yeah.
And
yeah.
Numerics can do that.
Yeah. If you believe this equation completely,
Number crunches, but I think we would need them in order to make
that. Yeah, but there are also fundamental questions. It's, what are the small corrections, microscopic corrections to equations like this? That's right, yeah.
But how realistic is it to describe spin waves since this is not a Lipschitz equation? Because if you start from, say, a functional integral with a set of point equation, then the speed waves have really fluctuations around it. So this is very important.
The spin waves you see, I guess, in these micromagnetic simulations, they are probably excited by pinning sites.
Macroscopic.
But there's an intrinsic excitation, which is evening the perfect crystal, which I already have.
Yeah.
Well,
then when you just move
the domain, you get excitations of spin waves, and they couple back to the domain. They renormalize
the mass into the model. That's right, yeah.
And they even lead, actually, this is an important point, they even lead to non-local equations of motions. They are local in time here, but this back actually is non-local.
Yeah, I mean, there are high-order derivatives. Sure. Yeah, this is... This is just linear in first derivative in magnetization, yeah. This is kind of still adiabatic, more or less, yeah.
So I have a question about spin pumping.
Okay, so this is, you know, this is an expense of your time.
Let's imagine I have a ferromagnet embedded in a non-ferromagnetic system, and let's imagine there's no spin orbit coupling anywhere in the system. Right, so I guess that's the spin battery was the stuff what you're talking about. So normally I would say that you know, if I have an external magnetic field which is has some what is the situation which creates a spin battery? So and how is it connected with the Larmor's theorem?
Okay, right. If there's no spin orbit interaction in the normal metal, you can apply the Larmor field reactor directly. And when you transport in the rotation, you will get some term which is proportional to the spin times H omega in the normal metal.
So, so one question about just the general framework, which works, as you say, very, very well. And what you're saying, you're drawing is sort of a sharp interface between the ferromagnet and the normal metal. Whereas really, I have some electronic system, and this is true for the other cases too. And let's say there's no spin orbit coupling, this electronic system has some total spin quantum number. And if I couple to it with long wavelength light, it couples to all of these spins all together, and it couples to the spins of what we might identify as a ferromagnet and a paramagnet altogether. So
what I described was what was happening at the interface. If you would like to understand
the the interface is something you draw, right?
That's right. And the result should be independent about how I draw my interface, right? And that we can actually prove is the case if you now have okay, so the model I made was that at the beginning was that the contact was small and the nodes were large, because in that case you can easily define an interface or a contact. But if you would like to define, let's say, a layer system which is diffusive, it's not so clear where your interface is and where your node is. So then you would have to either do some more sophisticated theories to see how is what is the effective interface resistance.
And for the particular case of spin pumping,
right.
Spin battery, let's say.
Right.
So exactly how does the battery work? You said this that there's an external electromagnetic field.
Yeah, so the external magnetic field, let's say, oscillating, which then excites the ferromagnet to start processing. And this ferromagnet then pumps spins into the normal metal. And after some time, there will be a buildup of spin accumulation there, which diffuses back into the ferromagnet, and you will reach steady state after some time. And in this state, is steady state, there will be an accumulation of spins in the normal metal out of the coolant, which in the ideal case is H omega, and the potential corresponds to H omega if there is no spin torque there. That is essentially the Larmor theorem, that you go to a rotated frame of reference.
And if
you can look at this in many different ways. You can look at it as if the spin flow between the ferromagnet and normal metal. But you can also look at it as energy being transferred and angular momentum being transferred, and both pictures are equivalent. You can show you get the
Shall I
turn
I was actually just going to use Blackboard and I'll try to be quick. So there's another example of the main wall, which is in quantum Hall systems. In quantum Hall systems, you can often have two bands of states, let's say a spin up and a spin down band, a Landau level, that's in general. And so let me just remind you that if I just have particles in a Landau level, I can label the states in Landau gauge. I get states which are plane wave states in one direction. I can label them by a plane wave in one direction, let's say the y direction, or by a guiding center in the other direction. And so it turns out where the wave function is localized in the x direction is related to the wave vector in the y direction. So this is the guiding center. Okay? So let's say I have Landau levels, a single Landau level, and I have a spin degree of freedom. Then if, for example, the g factor is zero, then the two Landau levels would have the same state. And so experimentally, you can realize situations where two Landau levels are degenerate. And in fact, there are experiments which in which it seems like there are domain walls in these systems. So there are two Landau levels, let me call them spin up and spin down. Let's say on the left-hand side is the spin-up region and spin-down region, and they can be separated by a domain wall. And in the quantum Hall case, there are experiments where currents are flowing in these systems, and the electrical properties change. And it looks like what's going on is that these domain walls are moving around, or at least if I use a magnetic language, the configuration, the magnetic configuration, the micromagnetic configuration of these ferromagnets is changed and the resistance changes. So it's very much analogous to what goes on in metals. These experiments are not really understood in any kind of detailed way.
Is it mean that some special relation between G factor and the effectiveness? To put them at the same energy.
So they could be, for example, two Landau levels which are in different layers, or they have different Landau level indices.
Sure.
Very often you can make them degenerate, so the spin may be a pseudosphere, okay, of some sort. And it turns out these magnets null magnetic anisotropy, or easy axis anisotropy, or easy plane anisotropy. But let's just imagine this is a system with zero G factor, or let's say where I can separately control the Zeeman magnetic field and the orbital magnetic field. So I have a big orbital magnetic field that makes Landau levels, and let's say I can make the Zeeman field using nuclear spin, for example, as suggested in a paper by Steve Gerben when he was visiting out here and talking to David Auchelon of these guys, but they've never done the experiment, so we have to bug them whenever they come. But in any event, you can imagine that the effective magnetic field changes sign at some point in the system, so you want to have spin up on one side and spin down on the other side. Okay? So I'm going to give two answers about spin torques in these systems, opposite answers, and talk maybe a little bit about what it means. Okay. So here's one answer. This is a ferromagnet, and I'm going to use the states in the band are these Landau gauge states, which I'm going to choose a Landau gauge where the states I'm talking about are extended in this direction along the domain wall. Localized across the domain wall. And I can, for example, describe the system using a Hartree-Fock approximation, very much like a band picture of what goes on in ferromagnetic metals. And So that means that this is Landau level filling factor one. To specify the state, I just have to say what is the direction of the spin in each of these states. Okay? And so if you do that, you can easily calculate that that the energy, or at least the interaction energy, the part that depends on these orientations is just, let me write it as, okay. Let's say these are unit vectors that describe the direction of the spin in a given Landau level state, labeled by these guiding centers x and x prime. And so there's some exchange energy which makes the energy lower. This is some exchange integral that makes the energy lower when the spins are parallel. Makes the interaction energy lower when the spins are parallel. And it has some finite range because these orbitals actually kind of overlap in space. Okay? And if the magnetization direction, for example, is changing slowly, you can do, you know, sort of a gradient expansion of this, and you'll get some energy which goes like sum over x, some coefficient times, let's call it A. And so it looks just like a regular ferromagnet. And if you solve the Hartree-Fock equations or minimize this energy, you'll find a normal type solution. This just looks like an exchange energy in a normal macroscopic description of a ferromagnet. you'll find that the orientation of the spin just gradually changes from up to down as you go through the system.
But this is not correct, right?
What's not correct?
Because you're not allowed to make gradient approximation there because this exchange energy is very localized on the scale of the magnetic length. Really on the scale of the distance between these lines.
Yeah, no, it's actually true that, you know, the gradient approximation is not so bad.
So I would expect that it's more or less a step-like profile.
Where the range of this interaction.
But the width is the magnetic length.
Yeah. So the range of this interaction is the magnetic length.
Yes.
The width of the domain wall is the magnetic length.
Okay, right. Okay.
And
you say that the width, it's gradually on a very, very small length scale.
It's a microscopic length scale, right? It's not a macroscopic length scale. Okay. If you let's call it delta x equals some over prime. Okay, so if you calculate these exchange energies, for example, when you minimize this energy function, you'll find that there's some exchange energy that splits the bands, which may be slightly reduced in magnitude when you have a domain wall, but not much. It points more or less in the direction of the magnetization, each point in space. So let me try and write this like this. Okay? So I have in this direction, let me draw the energy as a function of guiding center when you solve these Hartree-Fock equations. This is supposed to be energy I'm plotting here. This is the occupied Hartree-Fock orbital, which is spin up here, looks like a band picture of a ferromagnet, and spin down here. And as you go through the domain wall, the size of this gap is reduced slightly.
And Alan, that is a very dumb question.
Yeah.
There's no magnetic anisotropy at all in your model, and there is, or?
Okay, so there can be magnetic anisotropy.
Suppose there isn't.
So suppose there isn't, yeah.
Then why do I get a domain wall at all and not just a smooth profile that's the size of my system? There's no. I could just have the. I put boundary
right,
conditions that it's up on the left and down on the right, and it just
right.
Replicates.
Right. So probably, you know, the answer is you actually do, even in this limit. And the reason is that the gradient expansion is not really valid, in the sense that.
Well, gradient expansion would be very good for smooth configurations, wouldn't it?
So you're saying, okay, yeah. So there are two answers, I guess, to this question. One is that there can be anisotropy. In any of the examples we're interested, there is anisotropy. And if there were no anisotropy, then to get to stabilize a system like this, you'd have to have something like a moment position-dependent magnetic field. That favors the spins reorienting at some point in the system.
Okay. But I think this exchange, a non-uniform exchange, would allow you to label. It's not only on-site anisotropy, which you know, is
the tension. Did you mean exchange anisotropy? Or?
Yeah.
But,
okay. And, you know, in fact,
graphic model without.
Because if it's spin one half, you know, you have it gets one side.
Yeah. So let's say, you know, let's say there is anisotropy, okay? And so that just means this equation turns out to be slightly different, but it's more or less the same. Okay. So, so you get. When you go across to the main wall, the spin orientation changes because the orientation of the spins is gradually changing in the inside of the main wall. And so you can ask yourself about
would there be current-induced domain wall motion in this system?
And something that's peculiar, of course, in these systems is they're, in some sense, they're insulators in bulk. Then the gap doesn't go to zero anywhere, and the only states that can carry current are at the edge. And so it turns out if you, I actually have never done this, okay, but I imagine from this argument that, in fact, Jürgen started to do this calculation many years ago. But you may not recall. But anyway, these edge states. So there are edge states here, okay? And there's a gap, even though slightly reduced, there's a gap in the middle of the domain wall. And so the edge states will go something like that, okay? And so the answer is, and this is kind of the answer, more or less the answer of the theory of spin transfer torque. That you minimize the magnetic energy, minimize the energy of the system with respect to the magnetization orientation. You get domain walls. You solve the quasi-particle equations in the presence of those domain walls. That's what I've done here. At least I've pretended that I've done.
You should have two edge channels, right, for the upspin and the downspin, or?
There's only at the Fermi level. There's only one occupied state. Right?
Yeah, but it goes from up to down spin, right?
It goes from up to down.
So on the right side, you should have the up spin.
If I look at the energy, let's say, here, okay, going toward the edges of the system, I have up spin states, down spin states. So that's up, down. Fermi energy somewhere here. I get one set of edge states.
So when things got default, you're at the same time rotating your spin.
Yeah, right. So, but it's still one branch of states, and just like in a ferromagnetic metal, the quasi-particle states don't have, there's some mixture of different spin orientations moving through the main wall. It would be exactly like that. And so the answer, according to
the theory we just heard about that works very well, or at least answers most of the questions we know about metals, is that okay? I have these quasi-particle currents going through the system. Let's say I carry a net current through the system along one edge. The spins change from up to down. I'm breaking spin conservation, and so I must transfer this spin current, time rate of change of spin, to this mysterious thing, which is the order parameter. Okay. So there's answer A. Answer A is domain walls and quantum Hall ferromagnets. Of course, these are microscopically much simpler than real domain walls. But according to this answer, if spin is to be conserved, then you get the simple, ideal, who wrote it down first, Berger, velocity for the domain wall. That the way spin is conserved, here the stream of all electrons changing their spin from up to down. In order to conserve spin, I have to move the domain wall in that direction. Okay, so that's one answer. Here's another answer. Let's look at the theory of this domain wall. I can say, let me start describing the domain wall like this. I have on one side, I have spin up electrons. On the other side, I have spin down electrons. And if I didn't take the Hartree-Fock energy functional and find this domain wall extremum of the energy functional, then I would have a picture like this. I have spin up electrons, spin down electrons, and there's a delta function transition between the two, right? And so this looks just like a one-dimensional electron gas. Here I have, this is position in the x direction, or wave vector in the y direction. So it corresponds to momentum moving along the domain wall. The spin up electrons in this picture go along the domain wall. So here's the domain wall. Spin up electrons go along it in one direction. The spin down electrons go along the domain wall in the other direction.
Do your model have some spin orbit coupling?
No. Let's say there's no spin orbit coupling for now. Okay. So so this is actually a one-dimensional electron gas. Okay, and you could describe it using Luttinger liquid theory, and usually you define variables which are we're going to describe this using as variables the density of right goers and density of right goers is some Fermi function for the right goers, which are let's say that's these guys. So the density, if I call this KS equals zero, for example, K equals zero, then if I move the Fermi wave vector for these guys, I change the density, and the density for the right goers is KF over 2 pi, and the density for the left goers is, if I change KF for these guys, I'm actually decreasing the density, so it's minus KF. Okay?
Why now, no anticrossing in the center?
Well, if I did a mean field theory, mm-hmm. I would get an anticrossing at the center, but I'm taking a different approach here.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So this is the approach that I would use. If I said, here's a domain wall, in these very simple domain walls, they're microscopically very simple,
they just have electrons going one way with one spin and going the other way with the other spin. So the theory of a domain wall, which is the ingredient that's at the center of these theories by Tatara and so on, is basically the same as the theory of a one-dimensional electron gap. And the variables that are used to describe a domain wall are, let's call it, the position of the domain wall, for example, that appears in Tatara's theory. And if I want to say what is the position of where the spin changes from up to down, then I can't do better than saying that it's the mean point, if you like, of the end of the up goers and the beginning of the down goers. And so that's actually proportional to the difference in the density of right goers and left goers. Okay, I guess over 4 pi. And the other thing that appears in the theory of a domain wall is that Yaroslav mentioned is the some angular variable. And actually, let's say the spins go from up to down in the domain wall. This other variable is when I'm in the middle of the domain wall, what is the azimuthal orientation? Okay, where am I located at the in the equator when I go from the North Pole to the South Pole? And since these are spin a half spinners, you know that the azimuthal orientation is just the phase difference for spin a half particles between, let's say, down, spin down and spin up. That, in fact, is the other variable that's commonly used in these one-dimensional electron gas theories. And the density of right goers, for example, the wave function, at least I can say this as a mnemonic, wave function at the Fermi energy is e to the I kx, so the phase of an electron at the wave function locally is the Fermi wave vector times x, or in other words, this kf is really the spatial derivative. I guess this should be y, moving along the domain wall of the phase of the right-going electron. And this is the rho, so that's rho right, rho left, is minus the derivative of the phase of the left-going electrons. Okay? So, in fact, the other variable here is this variable that Stuart Parkin last week was calling psi, and this is the angular variable in the theory of a domain wall. It's the azimuthal orientation, and in this 1D electron gas language, it's actually equal to at least d derivative of psi is equal to rho left plus rho right. Okay. Now, if you calculate the energy of this domain wall, I won't do it since time is going on. It's not surprising that the energy turns out just to depend on the total density. Okay. So the energy in this theory, if I use this is the theory of a domain wall, and is actually some interaction parameter times okay. So So there's a difference here between the theory of a domain wall in that in the gradient expansion here, it's normally assumed that there's some term which is zeroth order in this gradient expansion, that there's some dependence, there's some transverse anisotropy. If you had purely uniaxial anisotropy in a ferromagnet and did a theory, the leading term would be just like this one. Okay, and so if then I can add, so in the theory so far, I haven't pinned the domain wall. If I add something that pins the domain wall, like a magnetic field that changes sign, for example, I can get some additional term, which is in the energy. So, for example, that's in a small displacement limit would be proportional to the square of the position of the domain wall. Okay. The main thing I want to say here is simply to point out the following conundrum. More or less, this theory of a current-driven domain wall is like current flowing through a one-dimensional electron gas. The answer there is the following. So let me imagine, here I have a domain wall. It turns out that if the domain wall is very weakly pinned, then in the interaction, in the language of a one-dimensional electron gas, this is actually a very strongly interacting one-dimensional electron gas with repulsive interactions. In this quantum Hall experiment, here's the edge states coming in and leaving the domain wall. On the other edge of the 2D electron gas, I have electrons moving along the edge, going away from the one-dimensional electron system that is in the domain wall. And then let me draw in the domain wall the way it would normally be done. Okay. Here's the domain wall. It has right goers and left goers that interact strongly with each other. Now let me tell you the answer about current-driven domain wall motion in this language. The answer is that this theory, which says I have coherence at low energies, I have coherence between the up spins and the down spins. In a one-dimensional electron gas theory, that Hartree-Fock theory is the Hartree-Fock theory that says you have a charge density wave ground state. And so you would say, if you were talking about this, that answer is completely wrong. And that instead, what you have is you have here a very strongly interacting one-dimensional electron gas in terms of the parameters used to describe these Luttinger models. G is very small. I have electrons coming in and going out, which are not interacting. But the most important thing is that, so this is a problem that people talked about a lot in the theory of Luttinger liquids. Here I have basically incoming and outgoing from this 1D system Fermi liquid leads, in effect, and at the other end as well. And here I have a strongly interacting 1D system.
Well, since this G,
So G is actually goes to zero if the domain wall is not hit, right? This looks like in a simple way of writing down a Luttinger liquid model, this is the interaction term, and the kinetic energy term would have to come from pinning of the domain wall. The normal answer is, and this goes back to papers that many of you are familiar with by Sophie and Schultz and other people, that if I have a current from the Fermi liquid lead incident on a Luttinger liquid, it's completely transmitted. And so if I
What that corresponds to in terms of spin torques is that the way that total angular momentum is conserved, if you like, is that this picture where the edge states where the quasi-particles are transmitted doesn't work, and instead the quasi-particles are perfectly reflected. And that also conserves reflected from here to here, which means that no spin angular momentum is transferred. So this is the opposite conclusion in any case. And maybe it's late enough that I should say, leave it as an exercise to for you to decide which conclusion is correct.
Do you know the answer?
Well, not for sure. I actually think that probably this answer is closer to the truth. But it sheds, I think, the aspect of spin transfer torque physics that is that this example illustrates is that maybe the mean field theory doesn't always work. I think actually for ferromagnetic metals it probably does. And these systems, it's maybe you can argue about whether it does or not. Yeah.
I mean, the difference in the two pictures is I guess, that on the right-hand one, there's basically a gapless collective mode localized to the domain wall, which can carry spin along it because of the in-plane rotation.
Right. So here,
you, for instance, added a little additional anisotropy, and that would help the left-hand picture had more channels coming in.
Right. I think if you added an in-plane anisotropy, it would help the left-hand picture. And maybe that's very important. But I think that in principle, let's say it's true that this picture is not completely wrong. That you can transfer angular momentum to the domain wall. Then the translation of that to a 1D electron gas is that conclusion that currents incident from a Fermi liquid lead onto a Luttinger liquid are perfectly transmitted. Even a strongly interaction Luttinger liquid would have to change. And anyway, that's an exercise. Okay, I'll stop.